It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, why is flu season hitting working-age adults so hard this year? And later, we'll be hanging out with a restaurateur-turned-farmer who will share delicious farm-to-table recipes and ideas.
Nobody likes getting the flu, but a report just out says this flu season seems to have a particularly devastating effect on working-age adults.
Now, this development challenges the long-held notion that flu only poses a life risk to young children and the elderly.
Influenza has killed at least 10 people here in Wisconsin so far this year, and three-quarters of the victims were between 18 and 50 years old.
We've asked Thomas Haupt, the Wisconsin's influenza coordinator and respiratory epidemiologist, to help us understand what's going on and how best to protect ourselves as we ride out the flu season. Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for the invitation to come on. I appreciate it.
I want to start out with some basics and talk a little bit about the numbers we're seeing without getting into just the age demographics just yet. How does the flu season shaping up in terms of the number of people who are getting it?
Well, it's comparable to a moderate flu season at this particular point. If you're looking at the entire picture and all the different age groups, the numbers are actually down a little bit from last year, where we predominantly saw people over 65 years old coming down with influenza. But again, without getting into the demographics and the severity of it, the numbers are probably where we would about see it for an average influenza season.
Now let's start getting into some of those demographics, because when we think of serious flu and the serious effects it can have, you think of young children, of the elderly being at risk. This year, I think I read somewhere we've already had 10 flu deaths in Wisconsin.
At least 10 deaths that we know of at this particular point. Now, flu deaths are not reportable except under 18 years old. But through our hospital influenza-associated reporting system, we are aware of at least 10 deaths and perhaps even more. The statistics have not come in over the last couple of days for that particular area, but it is potentially a very serious situation that we're dealing with.
And in terms of demographics, we are seeing more people in that middle range between children and between the elderly who are being hit by this.
Right. And that would include your 18 to 64-year-olds who have a very high rate this year of hospitalizations, including those that are admitted to the ICU unit, the intensive care unit, and those that are requiring mechanical ventilation. Normally, we would see about 15% of those particular age groups admitted to ICU. We're seeing about 25%, or 1 in 4, that are being admitted to ICU, and 1 in 10 that require mechanical ventilation. And this is just indicative of the 2009 H1N1 virus, the same virus that caused the pandemic back in 2009. It does tend to hit the younger and middle-aged adults much harder than it does the elderly population.
And to understand why that is so, you have to know a little bit about the history of those various strains of flu, right?
That's correct. Historically, H1N1 viruses, no matter what they are, tend to hit the younger people much harder than it does the older people. And in contrast, last year, that which had been 2012-13 season, we had an H3 year, an influenza A H3 year, which hits the elderly much harder, and we saw a significant increase in morbidity and mortality amongst the elderly population, and over 200 outbreaks of influenza A in nursing homes last year.
And every year, as I understand it, it's kind of an educated guess, I guess you would say, to try to figure out what strain of flu is going to be the big one that you're going to have to deal with.
That's correct. The CDC and the World Health Organization actually make a decision of what's going into the influenza vaccine in February and early March. So again, it's based on what's being seen in the southern hemisphere, what they feel might be circulating. The majority of time they hit the target pretty well, but there have been cases in the past where they have not hit the right virus, which obviously has caused severe years. But so far this year, it seems to be a good match with the vaccine, and we're hoping that the vaccine efficacy statistics that come out in February will tell us that we actually have a good working vaccine.
And speaking of vaccines, I also understand that in terms of being vaccinated against the flu, Wisconsin doesn't score very well.
Well, we score well in certain age categories,
okay,
but the ones that are hitting us where we did not score well, and this is the Trust for America's Health report, was the 18 to 49 and 50 to 64-year-olds, and that's the age group where we're seeing the more severe illnesses, where we're seeing the increase in hospitalization rates and ICU admissions and those categories that are on those age groups that are on ventilators. So that's a little bit concerning to us, but we are still trying to get the message out that there is vaccine available. It's not too late. We're right around peak activity in the state. You can still get vaccinated and protect yourself and protect those around you.
And I want to talk about that a little bit because there is continuing resistance to getting vaccine in some quarters. You know, some people say it actually causes the flu. Others say it has other impacts. From your standpoint, as someone who works in this day in and day out, are these legitimate fears that people should have when they're thinking about getting vaccinated?
No, these are some myths that have been going around for years. I mean, you really cannot get influenza from the influenza vaccine. One thing that I could reiterate is that if you do get the vaccine today on January, I think, what is 23rd today, that it takes up to 2 weeks to get full protection. So if you've been exposed to influenza during that time, you could get influenza, but it's not from the shot itself. That's not a live virus. So as far as it having other adverse effects, very, very few people get adverse effects other than a sore arm and a little bit of redness around the injection site. It really is a very safe vaccine, and it's also a very effective vaccine for both yourself and for the people who are around you.
So is it a good idea, though, to talk to your physician before you would do this, or is it okay just to go to a drugstore or wherever and get a flu shot?
Well, it's always good to consult your physician to be on the safe side. Those people who've had a condition called Guillain-Barré syndrome in the past really may not want to get this particular vaccination. That's like a neurological disease. There might be a few other instances where they're allergic to some of the components of the vaccine. So it's always good, when in doubt, to talk to your doctor about it. But if you haven't had any reactions in the past, you probably won't have any reactions now or in the future.
And let's say that I'm in that demographic that we're talking about, that middle demographic, the 18 to 49, and I get the flu right now. What do I do? You know, some of the things you talk about, going to ICU, having mechanical help breathing, that's some pretty serious stuff.
Very serious stuff. And usually a normal healthy adult who does come down with influenza will recover on their own, with the acute illness lasting about 5 days, although the fatigue that goes along with it could last for weeks, as does the cough. So most people will be able to recover on their own. But people who have underlying illnesses, asthma, heart conditions, diabetes, anything like that, even in my case, I take a drug called Humira for arthritis that lowers my immune system. That's where they need to contact their doctor and discuss whether or not they need to be put on antivirals, which will shorten the length and the severity of the illness.
And then finally, as you look ahead to the rest of the flu season, any way of knowing from this point how bad it's going to be or how good it's going to be?
Well, it's always hard to say. My thing that I try to get across to people is the flu is going to do what the flu wants to do. Right now, it appears, as I said, we're at peak activity, but it's not uncommon to have some influenza B viruses come up at the end of the season as well, just to add to misery and lengthen it a little bit longer. So we're hoping that we're, as I said, at peak, hopefully declining over the next few weeks and that the worst has passed. But nonetheless, we are going to see increased cases for probably another 2-3 weeks, even a month, before we get down to normal levels.
All right. Well, Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, too. I appreciate it very much.
That was Thomas Haupt. He is the influenza coordinator and respiratory epidemiologist with the Wisconsin Division of Public Health. On this Food Friday, we are talking about the farm-to-table lifestyle.
Our guest wrote a book about how he cultivated a feast made only from the bounty of his farm. Joining us is Kurt Timmermeister. His book is called Growing a Feast, The Chronicle of a Farm-to-Table Meal. Kurt, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, great. Thank you for having me.
So how did you make the decision to leave Seattle and your restaurant and settle on a farm? That seems like a pretty big move.
I did it fairly gradually. I had purchased a small amount of land originally and then picked up another piece next to it, and I just came to love it. I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the city less and less. And then finally I sold my restaurant and devoted my my life full-time to the farm.
So after you made that move to be full-time on the farm, was there a moment or two? Because, you know, that it's a pretty big jump, and all of a sudden you're trying to grow things and you've got animals to take care of and all of that. Was there a moment or two where you wondered, what am I doing here? What was this the right thing?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, honestly, I probably still think that. I'm kind of like, is this really everything I wanted? Because I still love the city. I still like to go to the city and enjoy it. But but I'm very much grounded on my farm now, and the food especially. I've eaten such great food for so many years now that it would be very hard for me to go back and have food that I didn't grow myself.
So let me ask a practical question, because you're talking to people in Wisconsin, and there are still a lot of farmers and connection to rural areas in Wisconsin. For somebody to move to a farm, you know, from the urban background that you had, how do you train yourself to be a farmer? How do you figure out how to take care of a cow, how to grow a crop?
So I grew up in the city in Seattle in a neighborhood and knew nearly nothing about farms. Seattle is not anywhere near as rural as Wisconsin, not in the least. And I just made a lot of mistakes. I read lots of books about it. Failed at many things. I wasn't very good at growing vegetables. I had lousy soil for vegetables. But then I kind of stumbled upon a cow, and I bought this cow because I wanted some milk. It sounded like a nice idea. Didn't know enough really about it to do it, but I still went ahead, asked lots of people about it. And I found that I have great land for pasture. I really like cows. I like milking cows, and I like making cheese. And as it turns out, we make very good cheese now.
Excellent. Well, you started hosting these cookhouse dinners
right.
to support your farm. Tell us about that tradition and how it got started.
I had seen a supper club in Portland a few years beforehand, and I really liked the idea of a group of people, 20 people around one big table, sharing a meal that would show up, and they wouldn't know what was going to be for dinner, and they kind of had this leap of faith. And so I started this cookhouse, this supper club. And people would come every Sunday. It would be at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and they'd have, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 courses. And we would make it from what we grew, you know, pork and beef and chicken and eggs and, you know, some of the vegetables that I did eventually get a little better at, and fruits. And we would make pickles and salamis and sausages and cheese and so on. And it was really extraordinary and super tasty.
Now, you say we, so I'm guessing it's not just you out there working this whole farm. It takes a village, right, to have a farm?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a whole village, but I would always bring in a cook to help me from the city or from the island. And then I would always have guys that would help me, you know, so that I wasn't milking cows every day. I would get a day off from that so that I could concentrate on the dinner and so on.
But is it primarily you working the farm?
When I started, absolutely. Now we make a fair amount of cheese now, so there are more people working there. But originally it was just me, and then a cook would come out on Sunday, and a guy would come out a couple days to help with the cows and so on. But I loved it, and I still love it, and it keeps me vital and excited about it.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the connection to the land and to the food, because these days you hear an awful lot about that, about how over the last 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, whatever, we've sort of gotten away from knowing where our food comes from, knowing, you know, the source of the animals or the crops.
Right.
And that sounds like it's a big part of sort of where you're at, that connection between
Absolutely.
Where you live and where the food is.
The reason I wrote this book, Growing a Feast, is that I wanted to show what went into, in this case, one dinner. And it starts with the birth of a calf a couple of years earlier, and then we make some cheese that's aged for a couple of years in this underground cheese cave on the farm. And I wanted to say that food has great stories, and it involves great, interesting people, and it involves different places and different techniques and different skills. And I want you to know that they are there. And it's not that important to me what you eat necessarily, but to know that there are fascinating stories behind it. And hopefully that will lead you to find better food with great stories behind it that's well made and well grown and well harvested and prepared and so on. And that's what I was getting at in Growing a Feast.
Yeah, and take us back to the birth of that calf, because it sort of starts out the book.
Yeah.
And it almost, I don't know if this is too big a word, but it almost sounds like an epiphany of sorts for you.
I think so. I mean, we've had a lot of calves born at the farm now, but I still put great importance on these days. I mean, we have, you know, maybe 10 or 12 or 15 calves born every year, and it's still exciting. It's still a big moment. I put a great importance on it. I put a bigger importance on it when a heifer is born than a bull calf, but I still get excited, and we take incredible care of these cows to make sure they're super healthy, and eventually they'll be part of the herd for milking.
Now, in your book, you focus on one particular feast and
right.
all of the work that went into it. And since this is radio, you know, we cannot see pictures or hear the sizzles. So I'd love to have you describe it. Tell us what you served.
Absolutely. It starts out with these pizzas, very thin pizzas in this wood-fired oven with tomato sauce and fresh herbs. Then we have this antipasti plate with a large variety of different things that we make on the farm. It's like whey ricotta, membrillo, a quince paste from the quince out of the orchard, some mushrooms that we forage, some chanterelle mushrooms, which are big here, different kinds of cheeses, pickled pumpkins, all this in an antipasti plate. And we have a soup made with this beautiful French heirloom squash with brown butter and fresh sage, shaved cabbage salad with pickled red currants, poached farm eggs. These beautiful pastured eggs are super goldeny, almost orange, with lots of kale and béarnaise sauce. Pasta, a beautiful tagliatelle with chicken gizzards and hearts and cipollini onions, super rich and tasty, earthy, with some breadcrumbs. Am I making you hungry yet?
You're doing pretty well, actually.
And then a beef roast that we braise in milk, because we have lots of milk around the farm, and braise so it's super tender, and then we take the sauce out and puree it, so it's this beautiful kind of caramelly looking color and super rich. Serve that with some bay leaf potatoes, some little fingerling potatoes that are boiled with lots of bay leaf, and then smashed a little bit with some butter on it.
This is a full-on feast. It sounds like a Roman banquet.
it's kind of overwhelming. People would come for hours. It would be, 4 or 5 hours sitting at this big, long fir table. And people would really get to know each other and talk to people. And it's not a 45-minute dinner. It's hours. And it's like you have a different sense of time, and you just kind of sit there and enjoy it. It's not, you're not eating, great volumes of food, but it's great variety. And it's very much about what the farm produces. Lots of it's about milk and cream and butter and these big hearty flavors.
Well, let's focus on the squash soup for a second, because we've already shared the recipe on our Facebook page.
Excellent.
And if you could maybe fill us in and tempt some people to head over there and see what it's all about.
Absolutely. So these are beautiful French heirloom squash that we raise. We raise a few different squash every year. I change out because I want to try the newest kind of interesting flavors. But this is one. It's called it's Brode. It's kind of this kind of mottledy looking orange one. It looks kind of ugly, but beautiful in its ugliness. And we cube it up, and we kind of steam it with a little bit of water until it's totally broken down. Some onions in it as well, maybe some fresh herbs in there. And then when it's completely broken down, we'll puree it either with like a hand, like a burr mixer, and a blender. Put in some more, of course, some milk, because we love milk. And it'll be this really silken texture. We'll usually put it through a sieve just to make sure that it's really, really smooth and silky. And then season it pretty well, lots of salt, lots of pepper. And then we'll take some butter, beautiful Jersey cream butter. We raise Jersey cows. And just brown it, not burn it, but just bring it till it's really nutty and brown. Pour that on top, a little bit of sage in there as well. And the sage will kind of pop when it hits that brown butter because of the oils in the sage. And then it's kind of crunchy, and you got the silky, and it got this little beautiful brown nutty taste. I think it's a gorgeous, gorgeous soup. And we serve with hot, hard rolls, super simple rolls, again with more Jersey cream butter on the side as well.
I'm guessing butter figures prominently into
butter,
a lot of this.
Yeah.
I like it. Yeah, we're from Wisconsin. We're into butter.
Yeah.
Well, what advice do you have for people who may be interested in being closer to their food and to grow their own food, but they may not have at their disposal a farm like you have?
It is challenging. I mean, because our food system's changed. Thankfully, it's also changed for the positive. We still have lots of farmers markets around the country. You have the fabulous one in Madison. That's the easiest thing. Go to the farmers market in the season. It's a great way to connect to the person who's responsible for that food, and it can tell you how they grew it and why they grew it and what they love and how they cook it. That's the easiest way. Off season, a little harder. I'm also, like, I sell to grocery stores. I sell cheese. So I deal with large stores all the time. I don't think they're bad places. Absolutely not. I'm very much the one who will say, if you want a great chicken or you want great beef or great pork, bother that store and say, I want something better. I want some great pork in your store because that's important to me now. And I think they'll respond to it. I think they'll source it, and they will find better and better
quality food for you. But the farmer's markets are the easiest way.
All right. Well, that's a great place to leave it. Kurt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Kurt Timmermeister, author of Growing a Feast, The Chronicle of a Farm-to-Table Meal. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. When you hear the term baby boomers, what do you picture in your mind? An elderly person nearing 70 or a spry 50-something?
Or maybe me.
Or
I'm
maybe
Gene Purcell,
you.
And I was born in 1960, so in theory, I'm a baby boomer. But that answer, that idea of an elderly person nearing 70 or a spry 50-something person is important because that baby boom generation happened between 1946 and 1964. But our guest that we're going to have on in a few minutes says to consider baby boomers as a single generation of people just linked together by common cultural experiences is incorrect. And think about that for a second. 1946, right after World War II, you know, think of Glenn Miller. 1964, think of maybe the Beatles. And then think about the kids born in 1964 and growing up in more of a Generation X environment. Is this really all just one generation that we're talking about?
That's right. There's a big chunk of time there. And our guest is saying that there really are two different sets of baby boomers. He calls them Boomer Classic and Boomer Reboot. And I'm guessing, Gene, that you're a reboot.
Well, you know what? I'm going to wait and see what he says. But I have to say, after reading the article and listening to that, I feel like more of a reboot than a classic. And so we will find out what our guest has to say about that, and I'll be listening very, very closely.
And we've got him on the line with us now. Joining us is Richard Perez Pena. He's a reporter for the New York Times. Technically a boomer himself, but at 50 years old, around Gene's age, he'd rather not be called one. And he's here to tell us why. Richard, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing okay. So let's talk baby boomers. Why shouldn't the people born between 1946 and 1964 be considered part of one big baby boom generation?
You know, the definition really just has to do with this demographic bulge and not with some sort of cultural identity. And I really feel as though the first half and the second half had two very different experiences growing up. And, you know, somewhere around 1954, there's this transition. And, you know, I was born in 63, and I don't really feel as though I experienced the same America, the same childhood as somebody who was born in 46, 17 years earlier.
So you describe the generation as having two distinct halves. What are they?
Well, I think probably the sharpest dividing line, it has to do with Vietnam. If you were born up until about 1954, there was, if you were male, there was a chance you were going to get drafted. There was a chance you were going to be sent to Vietnam. You knew people who were sent. You might even have known people who came back injured or didn't come back. If you were just born just a year after that, none of that was part of your reality. No anti-war protests, no worrying about being drafted. You know, I turned 18 in 1981. There was no draft and hadn't been since I was about 10 years old.
So some pretty different life experiences,
according
to the boomers. What types of things separate them?
Well, I think there are a number of things. And one of them is just all the sociological change that took place in the 60s and 70s. You know, if you were born in late 40s, you were largely formed as a person before a lot of that took effect. You were formed as a person before there was the pill. You know, that first was marketed in the United States in the early 60s, but didn't become universally available until the early 70s, before sort of marijuana smoking at a certain age was kind of started to be taken for granted, or before you know, the recessions of the 1970s and the early 1980s, you know, there was this period of absolutely unprecedented, almost uninterrupted economic growth from the late 40s through the early 70s. If you were born in 1946, you spent your entire childhood and the early part of your adult life in that atmosphere of unrivaled growth. If you were my age, you spent a lot of your childhood assuming that like recession and long gas lines and inflation were kind of part of the landscape. It was the norm. You didn't have the same optimism. I think you you know, you sort of took for granted that a lot of politicians were crooks. You know, the thing that you always hear from the older boomers is, do you remember where you were when Kennedy died? Well, I was 6 months old, so obviously I don't remember. But I remember where I was when Nixon resigned.
Interesting. So you're describing some pretty big fault lines there. When you describe it like that, it does seem sort of peculiar that we have this whole group of people from 46 to 64 lumped together as boomers.
Yeah.
And now there's also generational backlash against boomers. I mean, do you feel like you just as soon rather not be identified with the boomers?
It's not that I have any problem with them. I've seen that backlash, and I don't quite get it, to be honest, and I don't share it. But I feel as though when people talk about boomers, they're really talking about a Woodstock generation that I wasn't part of. It's not that I have a problem with boomers. I just don't particularly identify.
So do you feel like you and other people like you who were born later have more in common with Gen X?
Absolutely. And in fact, the original definition of Gen X does include me. I've forgotten the guy's name who wrote the book, but he was counting people from about 60, 61 on. And he was applying a cultural definition rather than a demographic one, which I think makes a lot of sense.
I think Douglas Copeland is the guy you're thinking
of. That's right. Thank you.
Yeah, it does. So why then, if there's so much cultural similarities between Gen Xers and late baby boomers, why have baby boomers gotten lumped together there?
It's just a matter of numbers.
It's a numbers game?
Yeah, the number of births in the United States just soared after World War II and kept soaring up until the 50s. It actually peaked in 57 at something like 4.3 million. And stayed above 4 million a year up until 1964, and then really started to plummet starting in 65. You see this very sharp fall off, and it keeps falling into the 70s.
And when you hear news stories now, you hear about aging boomers and the medical expenses associated with boomers aging, mm-hmm. and similar stories. Do you think that's not really me? Do you have a thing where you don't really identify with the generation that you're supposed to be in?
Yes, I have that all the time. But on the other hand, I did get an AARP card in the mail because that's one of the things that happens when you turn 50, whether
really?
You like it or not. So.
So there's part of that there. I don't know. This is obviously not going to happen. I think the boomer age span has been determined and pretty much etched in stone. But would you like us to be thinking differently about what boomers are and the different experiences that it contains?
Well, I think that was Copeland's big contribution, was to make us think differently about it and sort of lop off that latter part and say, culturally, this is a different group of people. This is Gen X. And I think that makes a lot of sense. But I'm not going to lose sleep over it if somebody calls me a boomer. You know, it's the definition that the Census Bureau uses based on the numbers, and, I don't have a problem with that.
Now, you said that people your age were decidedly apathetic about politics and social issues. Now, that sounds like Gen X, which is my generation.
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit more about why that was?
Well, I think there's a degree of cynicism that we grew up with and that we sort of took for granted. You know, I think that people were fairly idealistic about politics, about what America was all about in the Eisenhower years, in the Kennedy years. I hear people older than me talking about the enthusiasm they felt for Kennedy, the real idealism. I don't remember Kennedy. My earliest memories... I have vague memories of seeing Lyndon Johnson on the TV news, but my real earliest memories of the TV news are of scenes from Vietnam, and Nixon's is the first presidential face I have a really clear picture of, as a kid. And so I think that we had no idealism to spoil. You know, I hear about people older than me sort of having their idealism kind of curdled by the events of the 60s and 70s. We never had it.
Hmm. Do you think that's true of other generations that came later? Are there, breaks in Gen X that are similar to the boomers or even millennials? That you're born at one end, you get this experience, you're born at the other, and it's a whole different thing.
I don't know. I would have to ask them and give it some thought. But I did think of it going in the other direction. In my father's generation, he was born in 1924. He was 17 at the time of Pearl Harbor. He was in uniform for most of World War II. Most of his childhood took place during the Depression. Somebody born just a few years after him wouldn't have remembered the Depression and wouldn't have been old enough to be in the war. That's a huge difference, and yet somebody might lump them in as the same generation.
Well, we're talking right now with Richard Perez Pena, reporter for the New York Times and author of the recent article, I May Be 50, But Don't Call Me a Boomer. He's technically a boomer himself. At 50 years old, he'd rather not be called one.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. Do you relate to a lot of what Richard is saying? Are you a boomer, but don't consider yourself one? What do you think about that dividing line of Vietnam, and where do you fall on that line? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@WPR.org.
We're talking with Richard Perez Pena, reporter for the New York Times and author of the recent article, I May Be 50, But Don't Call Me a Boomer, talking about the divide within that giant baby boomer span from 46 to 64.
And we invite you to join in the discussion, too. Why do baby boomers differ in their life and cultural experiences when compared with one another? Are you technically a baby boomer, but don't consider yourself one? Why or why not? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@WPR.org.
And we're going to go right to the phones and take a call from Bill in Orfordville. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you? Yes, I always thought I was a baby boomer. I was born in 1942. I celebrated my 21st birthday on the Kennedy assassination on the 22nd of November. I fought in Vietnam, 63. I remember when there was only 150 million people in this country, so when you walk down the street today and you see four people, three of those people weren't there when I was a kid. I remember people who were in the Depression. My grandfather was a World War I vet. My great-grandfather fought with the Prussians against the French in 1870. I mean, it's a whole different perspective, and I thought I was a baby boomer.
So do you think that, you know, whoever made that decision should have lopped it off sooner based on cultural factors rather than basically births?
Oh, yes. I think in the early 50s, you know, there was a big shift towards the middle to the end of the 50s in the culture. They forgot a lot of everything from World War II back and started looking ahead. And then once they got done with the Vietnam stuff, I was absolutely horrified with the actions of people, anti-war protesters and those kinds of people, until I fully understood it because of the upbringing I had prior to all of this. Yet everybody after, you know, the 60s there, understood it in a totally different way.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Thanks for weighing in on that, talking about the same thing you're talking about, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think that the fact that there was such a different cultural experience for both sides of the baby boomer years has, you know, stopped it from maybe being as cohesive as it could have been?
I guess so, yeah. You know, I think that there are a lot of people my age who sort of scoff at the for lack of a better term, the self-importance of the earlier boomers and the cultural experiences they had, you know, talking about the events of the late 60s, you know. But I'm actually very sympathetic. You know, they felt like they were changing the world, and or trying to anyway, and in some ways with very good reason.
All right.
I don't think people my age ever had those kinds of ambitions for the most part.
It sounds like you think they've been sort of drained out of you by then.
Well, I just think there was a higher level of cynicism to start with. And, you know, not that plenty of people my age haven't done wonderful things. You know, I would note that, you know, Barack Obama is a Gen Xer by that definition. You know, he's at the tail end of the baby boom.
Interesting. All right. Well, thank you so much, Bill. And we'll go next to Ryan calling us from Prairie du Chien. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. How are you today?
Okay. How about you?
Good. Love it. I love the subject. I am a social studies teacher, a history teacher, and I've spent a lot of time talking about this stuff and thinking about it. I read an article a long time ago that said that if you were born in 64, in between 64 and 73-ish, he called you guys the original Generation X.
Mm-hmm.
And I read that about 10 years ago. I think it was Boston Globe, though, so I don't want to steal any New York Times Thunder or anything like that. Sorry. And then this, you had said something earlier about split in the millennials. Absolutely. I saw it happen. There was this really... I guess, what you'd call the idealistic Disney generation, I guess. And now you have a different breed in there right now. And I've heard them, you know, referred to as Z. I don't know, because we're lacking originality or something. But further, I wanted to point out that there's a really good book out there called, oh, now I can't remember it. The historians are Strauss and Howe, and they talk about how there's a cycle of Anglo-American, English history, but it is carried over into American history in our culture, with one generation raises their kids a certain way, and we have a four-generation kind of rotation right now.
Interesting.
Oh, that's really interesting.
All right. Well, thanks. A lot of interesting points there, Ryan. And Richard, what do you think about, you know, having the end of the baby boomers being called the original Gen X?
I guess that works for me. You know, I think that you can sort of slice and dice in a lot of different ways. I'm not particularly advocating any one set of definitions. But it's interesting the caller mentioned England, because I have a friend who's English who read my piece and said, you know, very little of this applied to us. We weren't in Vietnam. You know, we had different cultural experiences in a lot of ways. I thought that was pretty interesting.
That is interesting. I mean, I sort of assumed that generations were cross-cultural or multinational, I guess, to put it another way. Are they?
Well, up to a point, I guess, yeah. But, you know, every country is going to have its own demographic and political and economic and cultural trends.
Interesting stuff. All right. Well, thanks a lot for bringing up those points, Ryan. And we'll move on to Michael in Milwaukee. Hi, Michael. Click. All right. No more Michael. And we'll go next to Joe in De Pere. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
Hi.
I think you nailed it with the Vietnam War. I was born in 1954, so I graduated high school in 1972, and the class of 1971 was the last one that got drafted.
Yeah.
And now
there was a draft lottery held in 72, but nobody from that lottery was actually taken in the end.
Exactly. I enlisted, and I was like the guy that called earlier, oh, yeah, let's go get him. And then I got in, and I said, wait a minute, sorry about that. So, and then, you know, we went the other way and said, this is nuts. So, but you nailed it. That's the dividing line, is the Vietnam War. And with me, I was born, luckily, I guess I didn't get drafted, but I enlisted, so it didn't make any difference. But it had everything to do with Vietnam, with, you know, whether if you were drafted, you had to go. You had to go to jail, or you had to leave the country. I mean, those were your options, and anybody after that didn't have those options, and that makes all the difference in the world. Before that, the way you got out was if you were rich, you get a college deferment.
Yeah.
Right. So that's a powerful thing, the draft. And again, talking about the war dividing a generation into two different experiences. Do you think if it had been divided differently based on cultural common experiences, that it would have changed anything other than just sort of self-identity? Would it have changed policy or something more substantive like that?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. You know, I think that, well, you know, I don't know. I don't know. But, you know, on the subject of the war being a divider, I think that, you know, in years to come, we may look back on, you know, more recent time in the same way. You know, there was this 10-year window when, to one degree or another, this country, well, more than 10 years, this country was at war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think that that's going to be a real marker for that generation that the people just before and the people just after don't have.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Joe. We appreciate it. And we move on to Rick in Maquonago. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I guess I just got more of a comment than a question. It's really regarding the career aspirations and goals of the original or the early baby boom people that were carried with major corporations from their early career through mid-career and then into retirement and beyond. And then if you were born as a gentleman program here in the latter part of it, that sort of disappeared for millions of people. And I was wondering if you could maybe address that that concept as far as the skepticism and cynicism towards the American culture, where we thought originally we were going to be involved with corporations through to our retirement, and that basically disappeared
Thanks
for bringing that up. Yeah, talk if you would, Richard, a little bit about careers and the way the workplace changed.
I think that's a really good point. And, you know, in the 1970s, we really started to see some of the major American industries be in a lot of trouble, the auto industry, the steel industry. And you also had this period of time from 73 to 81 where there were three recessions, well, actually four recessions, two oil shocks, the closest this country's come in a long time to hyperinflation. You know, if you were trying to start a career in that window of time, you were very likely to have a lot of struggle before you got off the ground. I was lucky enough not to be at that point until the 1980s when things were going fairly well again. And there's all this research that says that what happens to you in the first years of your working life have repercussions for the whole rest of your working life. You know, your earnings potential, lifelong earnings potential, is permanently affected.
You mean like if you start out fast, you'll continue to succeed, and if you don't
get
out...
It's less about how you personally start than about what the economic atmosphere is. If you're starting your working life in a couple of years that are economically bad, you are never statistically going to catch up to the people a couple of years before you or a couple of years after you.
Well, that's depressing.
Yeah.
So that's the mark of some of the latter boomers, then, you're saying.
Yeah. Well, people sort of in the late middle, I would say, because people at the very end, like me, came of age in the 80s, you know, so we were brought up with all of that cynicism and not expecting the economy to be very good, and then it turned out that it was.
Wow. Well, why do you think that would be, though, that if you start out later, couldn't you just keep on working, keep on plugging away, get a better break?
You know, I don't know all of the sociology behind it, but I've seen a couple of research studies that show that there's a pretty strong correlation. You know, I don't know, maybe it's a bias against, by employers against hiring people who've been in the workforce for a couple of years and not done very well versus hiring someone straight out of school.
Richard, thanks a lot. Lots of interesting stuff to chew on there.
Yeah.
That was Richard Perez Pena, reporter for the New York Times. He wrote a column called "I May Be 50, But Don't Call Me a Boomer." And Gene, I saw you pointing at yourself a lot during that, so obviously you're identifying.
I was identifying. Coming up after the news, a proposal to legalize marijuana in Wisconsin. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.